President Trump is calling this week Infrastructure Week. He's proposing a $1 trillion project to rebuild the country's roads and bridges, backed by $200 billion of federal money and hoping to leverage $800 billion of private financing.
The great highway system, the interstate highway system, we don't do that anymore. We really don't. We don't even fix the old highways anymore. We'll take even fixing them, but we're going to get them going again like they've never been before.
It's unclear if Trump can get the support he needs in Congress for such a big infrastructure bill, and he wouldn't be the first president to face such a challenge. For a look back at the history, we're joined by Brian Ballow and Nathan Connolly. They're historians and co-hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory. Guys, welcome back.
Hey, Jeremy.
Good to be here, Jeremy.
And you would think that infrastructure, at least compared to some of the other issues in Washington, would be kind of a more bipartisan, safe consensus issue, but that's not what you found, is it?
No, not at all, Jeremy. It actually turns out to be one of the most contentious issues across American history, contentious on all kinds of fronts, whether the national government should do it or local government, and most of all, who should benefit from especially transportation projects, which really pick winners and losers depending on the route.
Well, what were some of the earliest projects that the government took on?
Well, probably the most uncontroversial big project that the government took on was lighthouses. I'll bet you didn't see that coming, right?
No, I didn't. I thought you were going to say something else.
Yeah.
Well, lighthouses were really important to the intercoastal trade, which was one of the things that really knit the country together after the Constitution was signed. And it was not controversial because everybody benefited from a whole system of lighthouses. But it was also not controversial because the national government was very delicate in the way it put together the system. It basically bought existing state lighthouses, added a few of its own, and it was very careful to use local contractors and local architects so that it really didn't leave a big footprint.
And once they had their lighthouses, they got to their canals, and the Erie Canal was, what, 200 years ago this year?
That's a great example of a state-funded project, right? I mean, we had a relatively small national government. We had a growing state that wanted to develop economically in New York, and they subsidized and paid for the construction of a canal that stretched all the way from the Hudson River to Lake Erie, and it was crucial for promoting transportation and trade across New York, getting beyond the Appalachian Mountains in order to open up the West.
There were also a lot of questions about like what it would mean to have these projects that would allow the federal government to really, you know, flex its muscle at the local level. And by the time you get to the Erie Canal's kind of final expansion of the era around the turn of the century in 1903, you really then have a kind of fervor around the country, almost a hot and heavy moment in the progressive era where people are trying to figure out how to engage in a kind of mass technocratic response to any number of social or bodily ills. I mean, you have so much building that's done around the turn of the century and through the 1920s that has to do with, you know, again, adding massive water systems to city grids, swamp drainage projects, even, believe it or not, racial segregation as a kind of Jim Crow prophylactic really against social conflict was part of this progressive era moment. And people are using publicly funded roads and green spaces to erect the infrastructure of segregation literally between people of different racial groups.
And was there the kind of pushback on some of those projects at that time that we see now? Were there people who said, we can't afford it?
Absolutely. I mean, it all depends, of course, on who's benefiting and who can do what with what. I think it's really important to point out things like, you know, germs and public health crises that can break out. The wealthy and the poor are equally, you know, susceptible. So a good water grid is really important. But you look at a figure like Robert Moses, for instance, the kind of great or some might say infamous master builder of New York City. He learned during this period in the early 20th century how to take advantage of local monies and state monies to basically, again, pick winners and losers in terms of infrastructure projects. And he was very effective at using those early lessons about how to combine different pots of money to then, of course, bring us into a much heavier moment of building that became the 1930s and later the post-war period.
Well, and that period, even if you drive around today, you see markers that say that this was built under the Works Progress Administration, that this came from that very big building period under Franklin Roosevelt. They did all kinds of things, dams, bridges, rural electrification.
That's absolutely right. And of course, you're talking about a period of the greatest economic crisis in American history. And there was pretty broad acceptance that the government had some role to play in terms of getting the economy going. And one of the best, and many people argue the most cost-effective way of getting the economy going again, was putting the people to work, building things of lasting value.
How come we don't do that anymore?
Well, I mean, I think we do build things. But, you know, I think it's also really important to go back to the so-called good old days of 1950s and 60s era big projects like, say, the interstate highway system. Right. I mean, you look at the interstate highway that was developed in the mid 1950s, 1956, the Highway Act comes into place, and it really does define the next 10 years of massive construction. It's really important to acknowledge the benefits of this moment. I mean, the American interstate highway system is by far the largest project ever constructed by humankind. Far dwarfs the Great Wall of China, the pyramids. You can see it from space. I mean, it is a massive project. But again, you know, the costs that are borne through a project that was effectively meant to solve evacuation problems or military troop movement problems during the Cold War was also used as an instrument at the local level to basically determine who was going to be allowed to live where, how you were going to have kind of urban growth, if you were going to, in fact, grow the middle class at all. It had to largely be on the backs of these kinds of projects. And a lesser known piece of this story, Jeremy, is the fact that many cities saw in the federal highway system almost a golden goose, right? The federal government was willing to spend cover nine tenths of the cost of what would basically be used to condemn properties, to displace properties. And so the definition of what, you know, some conservative observers might call pork barrel spending was really, you know, evident in the fact that the federal government could cover 90% of the cost that so many local officials wanted to incur to make sure that they were displacing populations or redrawing the boundaries of kind of prosperity and wealth in their own cities.
Jeremy, I have a more boring answer for you, which is a lot of the basic infrastructure that we need to communicate and get around is there. What it desperately needs is upgrading and repair.
Right. Right.
And that stuff is really boring and really hard to sell politically. I mean, imagine, do you want your dad to come home with a holiday gift that's a new basketball court and a new basket? Or do you want him to come home and say, son, I have a new net for you for your old hoop?
I fixed your toys from last year. Here
exactly.
They are.
They'll look all shiny when I'm done.
Well, and since you mentioned the interstate highway system, we have to take advantage of the fact that because we're talking to you, you're historians, and oftentimes you're talking about stuff that happened before there was tape. In this case, we have tape, and this is from the 50s. It's Walter Cronkite doing the voiceover for a promotional film for the Caterpillar Tractor Company.
We're going to get a brand new system of highways, roads, and streets in this country. We're going to transform our old, battered, outmoded, and overloaded interstate roads into superhighways that meet the standards and needs of 1975. From the farms to the heart of our cities, we're going to rebuild, improve, replace.
Okay, so let's flash forward to today, and I don't know if we're going to get an ad like that from one of the news anchors right now, but you know, when people compare what the United States does now with infrastructure to other countries, they often point to China and say, look how quickly China can build, a railroad or a highway. But then again, in a country like China, they can say, we're knocking down all these houses and that's what's happening. Has it become just much more difficult for the U.S. to build over time because of legal hurdles along the way, people suing, saying, I don't want you to build that highway right next to my house?
I think it has become more difficult, but it's become more difficult for the best of reasons, Jeremy. It's become more difficult because a far broader range of citizens have a say in the process that'll be used in construction. And I think that's what we call democracy. Look, one of the reasons that that golden age of public works that Nathan was referring to was golden is we had bosses. We had city machines, and actually they made a tidy profit on a lot of these huge projects. I think what we have today, at least as far as democratic values are concerned, is better.
I'm a little bit less optimistic than my colleague.
He always is.
There's also something to say about the fact that many people are much more resistive to the kinds of big projects that we used to build, right? I mean, there was certainly a sense of kind of national civic pride around building an airport system or, again, the interstate highways. And one of the things that you're seeing now, I think, is an interesting return to a kind of federalist ethos. I mean, there was an amazing exchange last week between Mike Mulvaney, the budget director for the president, and Senator from Michigan, Debbie Stabenow. And it was about $30 million that used to be allocated toward water preservation efforts in the Great Lakes region. And Mulvaney's argument was that people from Arkansas should not be expected to pay for water treatment projects in the Great Lakes area. And Stabenow's response, which is great, is that basically, look, the Great Lakes area has 20% of the world's fresh water. And having a country, and that's a quote, means being willing to be from Arkansas and to cover the kinds of costs that would be necessary to benefit everyone and preserve a kind of national and really global treasure that the Great Lakes water supply represents. And so bringing back some sense of national buy-in is also going to be necessary, I think, before you start talking about any larger kinds of projects.
Nathan Connolly and Brian Ballow, historians and co-hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory. Guys, thanks so much as always.
No, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
And you're listening to Here and Now.